You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about work, specifically surviving workplaces, because I feel like when you start a new job, when they're showing you around the office or the workplace where you're going to work, and they're introducing you to your new work colleagues, and they're showing you where the canteen is, honestly, like the thing that is daunting is not necessarily meeting the new people, although that can be a little bit scary as well. For me, at least, the scariest part is not knowing what all the unwritten rules are, because when you've been at a workplace for some time, there's just some things you learn to know. You learn to know like people's moods. You learn to know who actually has power in the office or the workplace. You learn to like read the room when you walk in somewhere. You can tell without anything being said that something is going on or there's some kind of like underground drama or politics that are taking place. You can kind of excuse yourself. But that takes a long time to acquire. Like I've been working for 15 years now, which is scary to say. And I definitely have walked into workplaces like naively thinking that the things that companies say on their work websites, their mission statements, their values correlates to how the actual workplace functions. And honestly, if you spend any amount of time in work or in different work contexts, you will know that that is just categorically untrue. So in today's episode, I'm going to go through some of the things that I've learned over the past 15 years. A sort of survival guide, if you will, in how to survive your workplace. And these are mostly things that people will not tell you. So they're the things that, you know, the person who's giving you orientation isn't going to tell you. It's not things that are going to be on the website. And honestly, a lot of the time as well, like your work colleagues aren't going to tell you. The only exception I will say, and I've had this at a couple of workplaces, is sometimes like if you're a Black person or a person of color, like the other people of color might give you like the Black or brown nod. And simply that means they might give you like top tips. Like they might say like, oh, watch out for that person. Or they might say, FYI, they say leave at this time, but actually that's not true. So outside of like people feeling like connected to you and wanting to give you like a survival tip, I guess, because they feel that connection to you, outside of that, people won't say anything. So I'm going to go through my top 10, not necessarily in order of importance, but definitely all things that I have had to learn the hard way. Now, the first one on the list is like so common and so often spoken about that it's almost cliche, but honestly, it's so true. And that is the idea that you only get one chance to make a first impression. Now, simply what that means is that when people first meet you, when they first experience you in a work context, how they observe you in the first hour, the first few days, the first few weeks, is basically going to be the lasting impression that they have of you, even if you change like dramatically or drastically later on down the line. Often people will reorient themselves into remembering how you were when they first met you. So you're kind of forever trapped in that initial first period when people are gaining that their impression of you. I personally think this is actually a very powerful tool that you can use in your advantage or for your advantage, because it kind of means you have to be on your best behavior, like your very best behavior for the first little while, but you can basically dine out on that for a very long time. So how you dine out on that is for the first like 6 months, or certainly for the first period where you are under probation, so when you haven't passed your probation, and even the period immediately after, make sure you're on time. Make sure that you're seen to be working hard. Make sure that you don't leave before your manager or your boss leaves. Make sure that you look presentable. Make sure that the work that you deliver is at a high caliber, at a very good standard. Make sure that it's delivered on time. Make sure that people have the impression of you that you've got a great attitude, that you're committed to working, and that you tick the things that you're supposed to tick off. Like, you know the things that you're supposed to know. You show up on time because that's always expected of you. You produce a good standard of work because, again, that's what you're paid for. And when you behave like this consistently for like a 6 month period or a 3 month period, or at the very least for the duration of your probation, but also a little bit after, because you don't want to seem like it's a complete switch up, which you shouldn't do, then what happens is that people just gain the impression that that's who you are. So what happens is that if you have been consistently on time, being on point for like 3 months, 6 months, and then one day you're late, all they'll think is, wow, something extraordinary must have happened because they're never late. Or if you produce on a couple of occasions like work that isn't to the highest standard or the standard that you previously produced in the first like 6 months, all people will think is, one, they're less likely to notice. And even if they do notice, they'll just think that this is like an off thing, or you've made a mistake, or they'll be very generous in their interpretation of your work. The reverse is also obviously true. Like if you show up to an interview late, for example, even by 5 to 10 minutes, like forget about it. Like that's their first impression of you, that you're somebody, even when you have something very important in the calendar, like a job interview, that you show up late. So you could give like the best interview of your life. You could be charming and charismatic, show up looking amazing, knowing the things that you need to know. But ultimately, you showing up late and sweaty and having to like shake their hand and make excuses, automatically you're starting off that interview at like minus 100 points. And that's also true in the work context. If you show up at work and you're not on your first few days and your first few weeks and your first few months, and you're not at the top of your game, that's going to be the lasting impression that people have of you. And it's almost like you're starting that work or that new role at minus 100. And what that means in practical terms is that their first impression of you either way is amplified. So if you're somebody who's shown up late a couple of times here and there in the first couple of weeks or the first few weeks of your role, then even when you're like 2 minutes late, to the people who have noticed that you're late, it'll feel like it's 10 minutes. Or when you're 10 minutes late, it'll feel like it's half an hour. Or if you've delivered work that was like kind of sloppy at the beginning, then again, that negative impression of your work is going to be amplified. Like they'll get the impression that you're sloppy or lazy or not hardworking or are incompetent, because again, people lean into the first impressions of you. So they'll want to find information that confirms that their first take on you is correct. So again, either way, like you can either be ruined by that first impression or you can dine out by that first impression. So if you are doing the right things, like I said, it'll be amplified because again, the person is trying to find, it's confirmation bias. They're trying to find information that validates their first impression of you, because people don't like to be wrong and they tend to be lazy in expanding how they think about people as being complex, changing beings. They like to think of them in a way where they can easily categorize that information, that person, like, oh, like this person shows up on time and has shown up on time like the first few weeks, so that's a punctual person. That person was polite and courteous and hardworking, so that's the labels that I attach to them. So when it comes time to you deviating from that first impression for whatever reason, their natural inclination is to fall back into their first impression of the first impression they had of you. So again, like it's a very, very dangerous position to start off on, like messing up at the very beginning, like save your messing up for later down the line. Now that's not to say that if you've been in a workplace for a while that you can't ever change how people think about you, but it's going to take a lot of work, and also it's going to have to be for a very consistent period. Like you're going to have to literally come in a new person, like maybe switch up the way that you look so that people feel like you've had like a come to Jesus moment and you've taken an active decision to change your impression. You're going to have to do that thing, like rectify the things that you were doing wrong in the eyes of the people who've got the power to like affect your future. So you're gonna have to prove this new version of you consistently to your manager, to your work colleagues. And that might mean changing the way you interact with them. Like if you're somebody who's seen as lazy, for example, or not reliable, then you being seen in the canteen, like kikiing with people probably isn't going to help your cause, because again, they're going to use that information to say, oh, look at her like laughing and skiving off as usual. Or if they see you in the smoking area, they're going to think, oh, look at her again, avoiding work. So again, the things that you do naturally, because you've set a negative experience for people around you, the information that you Like, even innocent things that you're doing are going to be seen through a negative lens. So you're going up against that. So the only way to kind of break away from that is literally to change your routine. Like, think critically about the things that could be interpreted through the negative lens that you don't want, and just do the opposite. It also means potentially hanging out with different people, because people are going to have an association of pairs together. So if that's what, that's why it's kind of important to care about who you socialize with, because if people see you as lazy, then they see the people you hang out with as lazy as well, and vice versa. So if you're trying to have a rebrand of your identity in the workplace, it might also mean switching up the people you hang out with. It might also mean like adopting new friends. It might mean having like a one-to-one with your manager and talk about your new goals, not in a way sort of like, I'm a new person, look at me now, but just sort of like set the expectation that, listen, I really want to progress and I want to achieve X, Y, and Z. And these are the things that I'm going to do. And I hope that you will support me in that journey or in that, you know, in that goal. But it can be done. It's just, it's just very difficult to do once you've set the standard of who you are. So sometimes, honestly, I do feel like it's worth just breaking with the past and starting somewhere fresh. But if you feel like the damage isn't too much and you can rectify that, then start from scratch, essentially, and pretend as though you're starting work for the first time, and set and try and set a new first impression. The second thing that's sort of an unwritten thing is that attractiveness bias is going to exist everywhere. Like, we already know that it exists in TV and film. That's why when you turn on Netflix or turn on your TV, like, the person you see, the people you see on TV, like, 9 times out of 10 are good people, are good looking people. And you know that because when you see somebody who's not attractive, you're kind of taken off guard. It's slightly different, I would say, for British TV, in that people often say that they don't necessarily have the best, like, teeth. But even when you compare them to the rest of the population, they are just going to be above average good looking. So that speaks to the idea that there's attractiveness bias, or attractivity bias, if that's a word, in like the things that we consume. That bias also exists in everyday life. Like, if you like stalk Reddit pages like I do, you'll read all the time about how people are treated differently, like, before they lose weight versus after. In the after weight loss, they're always treated like better, and it kind of like taints their view on humanity, because they realize for the first time that how you look does affect how nice people are to you, how kind people are to you, how generous they are to you, how they interpret the actions, your actions. That bias translates from the screen to like to interpersonal relationships. It also transfers to the workplace. There's a reason, for example, when you go to a restaurant, and I have worked in restaurants as like a teenager and early adult, my early like 20s, like when I was 21, 22. And I will tell you for free, like, the better looking people are always at the front. The people who don't look as good are always at the back. And this is really disgusting behavior, but it's true. I worked at like I worked at Fortnum and Mason's back in the day. And they literally would check you over. They would check your face over. They would see what makeup you're wearing. They would like look you up and down, make sure you look polished. And yes, make sure that you looked attractive. And if you looked at the people who are at the front and the people like serving tables, being behind the bar, being at the tables, waiting on people versus the people in the kitchen, the difference was clearly in looks. That's also the case when you consider who works in shops. Like, if you walk into Zara, or you walk into H&M, you walk into whatever department store you go to buy your clothes, you will also notice that they choose the best looking people to be the client facing people. So again, this bias like exists in different workplaces. And sometimes we believe that it's only in client facing roles. So it's only in roles where you're interacting with the public. Like, let's say you're a waitress, or let's say you work in a shop, like in retail. It's also the case in non-client facing roles. Even in offices where people aren't interacting with the public or with clients on a daily basis, attractiveness bias still exists. And although there are many different ways to be attractive, you know, like, in many ways, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, there are just certain things that you need to make sure that you're not deluding yourself, like, about. Like, there are, like, let's say you work in a place that is very conservative. there's no point you going in with like blue hair or purple hair, because ultimately what they are going to deem as attractive is going to be in accordance with like their corporate profile. If you go onto their website and everybody who's pictured there has like a short haircut, if they're men, they're wearing like a shirt with like a blazer and maybe some casual chinos, and the women are wearing like pencil skirts and blouses, or they're wearing like work dresses, and they all seem conservative. There's no boldness in anything that they are wearing or in how they're presenting. Their nails are nude. Their hair is like a natural color. Their makeup is understated. The men are just conservative looking. Then from the eyes or from the perspective of that company, attractiveness looks like the people they've chosen to put on their website. If you work in a more creative industry, that might look different. It might look like people have more personality, maybe they've got more color, maybe they're more vivacious, whatever it may be. But each company and each organization is going to have like their sort of like version of what attractiveness looks like. So make sure you're like adapting yourself according to the workspace. The other thing, the elephant in the room that I have to mention, is weight is obviously going to be a very like significant component. And on the one hand, like, we would like to live in a world where people aren't as shallow as to believe that the size that you are determines the quality of your work. But we don't live in that world. And what we know from studies after studies is that people who are carrying extra weight, like significant extra weight, I'm not talking about like 15, 20 pounds here or there, I'm talking about significant amounts of weight, they are discriminated against at a very extreme level. They're discriminated against in the interview process, in the hiring process. They're less likely to be progressed, so advanced, like given promotions. And also they have negative stereotypes attached to their behavior. So you could have two people sitting down at their work, at their desk, having lunch, and they're both having like salads. And the person who's a bigger person will be perceived as being gluttonous, even though they're literally eating the same food. Or because they assume people who are bigger, like, don't exercise as much, they might attach the adjective of lazy against them, even though that's not true. So again, like, there are things that just work against you regardless of how we personally would like the world to be. We would like the world to be a place where we are judged on the content of our character and the quality of our work. But realistically speaking, we know from everything else in life that that's not the case. We know that when we turn on the TV, people look a specific way and they're rewarded for looking a specific way. We know that study after study shows us that people who are deemed more attractive by mainstream society tend to progress at a higher rate, like even given the same qualifications. And so I like to delineate between how I would like the world to be and how the world actually is. And if I know something, there's no point me deluding myself and saying, like, I'm going to like defy societal norms and societal expectations, and I'm going to show up in a way that challenges the space. Like, for me, I'm just making life more difficult for myself, especially if it's something that I can change. So make of it what you will, but certainly, like, how you look, how you present, how you show up in your body at work 100% has an impact on how people perceive you, how they treat you, how they imagine you in the future in terms of whether you're leadership material, whether you represent the brand properly or well, or whether they want you being in positions of representing the firm. The third thing that I've learned is that people are not going to tell you about the social rules that you violate. Like, a lot of the time when you're doing something wrong, and this is not like on paper wrong, it's not like you're not delivering your work, you're not doing your work well, or you're not showing up on time. These are the things that they can point to in the contract and say you're not fulfilling your side of the role. These are like unwritten rules. When you break those unwritten rules, it's not as though you'll get an email from your manager saying, BTW, you broke that social rule and now this is going to affect you in this way. They silently will observe you breaking that rule, and then they will just like punish you behind your back. One of the ways where you are punished without you realizing, and honestly, we should all know this, but I don't know. One of the things is like hygiene. most people feel super uncomfortable having to tell even the people they're close to, like their lovers or their friends or their family members, that they've got bad hygiene. So let's say like they've got bad breath, they've got bad body odor, or their hair doesn't look clean, whatever it may be. They find it incredibly uncomfortable because it involves criticizing somebody in a very intimate way. And so a lot of the time people would rather just sort of turn the other eye, like pretend as though the problem doesn't exist, and sort of not say anything, even in personal relationships, although I think that's very shitty behavior. But in the workplace, they're even more incentivized not to tell you anything because, again, they don't know you intimately like that. They don't know you very well. There could be negative consequences for them. It could be perceived as being like bullying behavior if they tell you that information. They don't know how you're going to respond and whether you're going to try and get them in trouble. And so in the absence of not knowing exactly how you're going to respond, and honestly, them not really having that much loyalty to you anyway, like you're just a work colleague to them, they just choose to let you be punished by this thing in secret, like unawares to you. So you'll be walking around and you'll be wondering why people avoid you, or why you're not invited to lunch, or why you're not invited to after work events, or why it seems that people don't seem to engage you in conversation, or why it feels like you're on the outside looking in but you haven't done anything wrong. Sometimes it's because you violated a social norm or social etiquette like that. And one of the ways to guard against this is just to practice compassionate, like, transparency in your everyday life. Like if you make it difficult for people who care about you, like in your outside work life, to tell you things, you're gonna fall victim to information being withheld from you that could be beneficial to you. So if your partner like gives you feedback and you always take it badly, or your siblings give you feedback and you always take it badly, or your friends give you feedback and you like blow up, then you're going to make it more difficult for them to come forward and sit and tell you things that you need to know. So if you practice just being open and being receptive to information, chances are people are going to intervene and help you when you need that help. So somebody might tell you like, oh, like, hun, I don't know what's going on, but I've noticed the last few times you've kind of had bad breath. I think you might have to go to the dentist. Or I don't know if it's you've changed deodorant, but I've noticed the last few times we've met up, like you've kind of smelled of BO. Or whatever it may be. Or I've noticed X, Y, and Z, like insert the host of things that people might notice about you. So it's very helpful to be open in that way in your personal life, because it protects you in the work sphere. Because in the work sphere, people are not going to have those conversations with you, because it makes them feel super, super uncomfortable. I used to work with this guy who was like nice as pie. He was honestly a very nice guy. He was very, very helpful. And he would be the kind of person who, if like somebody needed a lift to the train station, he'd be the first one to offer it. Or if somebody needed help learning like a program or learning something about work, he'd be the first person to volunteer. Honestly, like a nice team member to have. The only problem with this particular person was that he had the worst breath I have ever smelt in my life. And when I first started the firm, I thought it was just like an off day. So, you know, didn't think much of it. I just thought, oh, okay, they're having a bad day. But then after I'd been there for like weeks and months, I realized they just have a medical issue. And I knew it wasn't like an issue based on what they've eaten, because again, garlic, you know, when somebody's eating garlic or eating food that doesn't smell good, you know, it's just a temporary smell. And because I had gone on overnight work trips with him, like to client meetings in like different cities, I knew that he actually had very good hygiene. Like I saw him with his toothbrush, I saw him with his floss, I saw him buy like extra toothpaste and mouthwash at the airport and stuff. So I knew that he was aware of those things, but yet every day without fail, his breath was terrible. So bad to the point where if you were walking through the hallway, you would know that he had been there because you could smell his breath in the hallway. Or when he would visit your office and the door was closed, like he would, his breath and his like oral odor would fill up the whole room. Now, the problem with that situation and that dynamic is that this person clearly was never ever going to progress. They're never going to be made a manager or made given a position of leadership, because that would mean that they are going out there independently representing the firm. And if they have this elephant in the room of bad breath that they consistently have, and everybody in the office has observed that and management has observed that, then of course you can see how that's going to hinder their behavior. Now, this is obviously true in terms of hygiene and personal hygiene, but it's also true in other social etiquette rules. Like if you're somebody who like doesn't get along with people, or you antagonize people, or you ask them inappropriate questions, or you make inappropriate jokes, and people can't trust you to be independent and client facing, for example, they're not going to tell you that you make people feel uncomfortable, because again, it's hard to pin down. Like when somebody has like a sense of humor that people don't appreciate, that's not something you can put down on an HR form, because it can come across as being bullying to write down like your jokes aren't funny, they make people feel uncomfortable, or the way that you ask questions are irritating. Like those social dynamics and social etiquette rules aren't going to be told to you. People will just sort of either avoid you or avoid interacting with you, or they'll just silently punish you for those things. So again, like the only way to sort of guard against this is in your personal life, creating that feeling around people who love you, that they can tell you things without you like losing your shit, essentially. The fourth thing is that, and I feel mean saying this, but it's that you should be very careful about people who choose you at work too quickly. So I don't know if you've had this experience, but I have, of going into a new workplace and there's somebody who like from like minute one that you're at the firm are super keen to be your friend. Like they insert themselves, and this isn't like your buddy. Like, you know, sometimes when you start work, they assign your buddy to like show you around and to like basically for you to have a point of contact where you can ask questions to. I'm not talking about your assigned buddy. I'm talking about somebody who just gravitates towards you and they want to spend lots of time with you and they want to be very helpful, which is nice, but it feels a little bit too much too soon. Or they try and make you guys like instant friends, but you haven't gotten to know them yet, and the whole thing feels a little bit desperate and a little bit forced. The reason why sometimes this person is to be avoided, or the reason why they're doing that, is that often they're like the pariah or the social pariah of the group. So in my case, like I just spoke about the guy with bad breath, was basically like that with me. Like from day one, he was super close with me. He wanted to be my friend. He wanted to hang out with me. He wanted to spend every waking moment in the office with me. And initially I was like, okay, I mean, this is nice to be welcomed in this way. But over time I realized that people didn't interact with him and they never visited his office. They didn't invite him out to things. They clearly didn't want to spend time with him because of his breath issue. And so he was lonely. And so when there was a new person in the office, he immediately tried to like insert himself in their lives because, again, he was sort of socially isolated because of like his breath issue. People who are too keen are often people who've been isolated for other reasons or for particular reasons. In the bad breath guy, like honestly, I think that's unfair in his case, and I don't think you can make the call. I don't know if it's worth like not being chummy with somebody because of that, but certainly other people are going to avoid you as a pair because you're now connected to this person who they don't want to be around. But there are other reasons why people can be social pariahs, and they're not necessarily innocent reasons. Like I've learned the hard way that sometimes the reason why people are socially isolated is because they're not very nice. They may seem nice on the surface, like they're friendly, they want to chat to you, they want to sit with you, they want to invite you to lunch or coffee or to hang out after work, or to like visit each other's offices if you work in an office, or chat to you on the floor if you work in like in a store or whatever. But sometimes like this, the group has spoken. You have to ask yourself, why is it that there's like 50 people on this team and this seems to be the only person who doesn't have friends, or who people don't seem to interact with, or people don't seem to gravitate towards? Often it's because they are socially awkward, so they say odd things, rude things, uncomfortable things. They don't know how to be socially appropriate. And you can, because you're being compassionate and you're showing them pity, you can overlook the more like negative components of their personality. So I've had the experience, for example, where I've had friends, like work friends, who in retrospect I consider pity friends. It's people who you see are socially isolated, and so you decide to be friends with them because they've gravitated to you so much. And also because you see that they don't have that many people around, so you decide you're going to be the good person, quote unquote. And what has happened to me time and time again is that these people always end up like being shitty in some way. Like in a university context, I like this guy befriended me, and he befriended me hard, like wanted to be around me all the time, wanted to practice with me all the time, wanted to be friends with me all the time, was always keen for us to do a competition together. And I kind of had like a regular debating partner, but on finally I relented and I was like, okay, yeah, let's do it. Let's have a competition. Let's do a competition together. So we did. And when I tell you, this person made me feel so terrible. Like, we came out of one round and he said something like, you're the reason why we've lost. And when we were going through like practice, he would be so rude in his feedback. He would basically make me feel like I was just a numbnut, essentially, who didn't know anything, who was like holding the team back, and would be hypercritical in an unkind way. And when we didn't do well in a round, he wouldn't say, that's okay, champ, we'll get the next round. He would blame me for the loss. Now, he wouldn't do it in like an aggressive way or like in a mean way. He would just say in a matter of fact way, like, you're the reason why we lost that round. But it's still a pretty nasty attitude to have towards a team activity, a team sport. So sometimes in work contexts, these people are isolated because they are like that. They may on the surface seem like they're nice people, but they must have done something for the whole team to not like them, or for the whole team to be repelled by them, or for the whole team to sort of like keep their distance from them. Sometimes, a lot of the time, it's been my experience that it's better to hold back and get to know absolutely everybody and know them for like a few weeks, and then decide who you're going to spend more time with, decide who you're going to befriend before you jump all in. Because what happens sometimes is if you become friends with that like work social pariah, other people will make assumptions about your character. They'll see you together and they'll assume you're the same kind of person, or because you're with that person, they won't approach you. And then one, you've narrowed like your sphere of influence, because now you're not friends with people you should be friends with, or you would like, or you who you'd like to be friends with ideally. And secondly, you're being tainted by the same brush with which the social pariah person is painted, when you haven't done anything to deserve that stigma or that stereotyping or that assumption about your character. So it's actually much better to be cautious when people are overly keen to be friends with you when you haven't earned it. Like, I often think, like, why aren't you treating me like the stranger that I am, to quote my sister? Why are you so keen to get to know me when I haven't done anything to deserve it? I haven't made you laugh. I haven't shown you attention. I haven't shown that I'm a good friend to you. I haven't helped you with anything. And yet, despite me giving you absolutely nothing, you're so keen to attach yourself to me. Chances are it's not about you. It's about them using you and them wanting to be friends with you so quickly before you have a chance to realize that they're kind of like a persona non grata. They're kind of a person who's like socially isolated because of the things they've done or because of other things that have happened that you don't know. But either way, there are things that reflect poorly or negatively on that person. And there are also things that are unfortunately going to be reflected onto you, even though you haven't earned those things. Sometimes you can feel like a bit bad or a bit guilty, but you have to remember that you ultimately don't know. You don't know this person, you don't know these people. Secondly, you don't owe them anything. It's kind of like the pressure you feel when you're on the street and some guy asks you for your number and you don't want to give him your number because you're not interested for whatever reason, but you feel like you don't want to be rude. So you just give him your number knowing that the minute you turn the corner, you're going to block him, or you give him your number and you're going to change the last digit. But the only reason you're doing that is because you feel uncomfortable, and you also feel like you don't want to be perceived as being mean. But ultimately, there's no reason why you should sacrifice your interests and what you want for the benefit of this complete stranger, or for the benefit of what this person wants, especially when they haven't done anything to earn it. So it's literally the same thing in the work context. It's like, you don't owe anybody your friendship, and you don't owe anybody the idea that you're going to prioritize their interests over your own interests. It's in your own interest to get to know the lay of the land first, to get to know everybody first, to get to know what the social dynamics are, to know what the political dynamics are. And then on that basis, from a perspective of being informed and from a perspective of you having decided and having used your agency to choose who you want to be friends with, then decide to be friends with people. And if it so happens to be like with a person that try to attach themselves to you because you find out that you actually do like them, like legitimately, then that's absolutely fine. But I tell you, like 9 times out of 10, usually the reason why they're so desperate is because they have done something wrong to isolate themselves in that workplace. Now, the fifth thing on the list is the idea that your hard work has diminishing returns. Now, what that simply means is that sometimes people think that the harder they work at work, the more hours they put in, the more effort they put in, the more dedication they put in. And that might look like staying later. Let's say you finish at 5, but you consistently stay until 5:45 or 6. Or you never leave before your manager or your boss does. Or you take home with you on the weekends and in the evenings. Or you sign yourself up or volunteer to take on extra work. Sometimes we take all those actions under the impression that we are going to be recognized and be rewarded for that hard work and dedication and commitment. And whilst that might be true, like in the short term, so initially when you're superiors notice that you are standing out in that way, like you are going to get some brownie points. You are going to get like a pat on the back or recognition, or you're going to endear yourself to them. And that initially feels good because it's nice to be recognized for our hard work. But those, that effect and those like pats on the back and that reward is incredibly short-lived, because what happens as time goes by is that that hard work and that extra effort you're putting in and that extra commitment and that extra dedication isn't seen as being extra. It's seen as being the base level for you. So they start to take your commitment and the work that you put in for granted. And it's very easy to see why, like on a psychological level, like we get accustomed to the way that people behave. So if I'm always staying till this time, then the next time I don't stay, like that's the thing that stands out. Not the fact that I always stay late, but the fact that I haven't stayed late on this occasion. So it might seem like I'm working less hard than I am, even though on balance, I'm working harder than everybody else. That's one. So the new standard is the basis on which you are compared to other people and even to like yourself. So they're holding you hostage to this new standard. The second thing is that psychologically, when we get things for free, we diminish those things in our eyes, whether we want to or not. It happens like without our conscious buy-in. So the idea is that you are paid a salary. Like if you're a salaried worker and you get paid like £30,000 to work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. That's what you're contracted to do. And within your contract, they loosely define like the areas of work and their expectation for you, right? So that's 30K. If you are working 9 to 6 every day or 9 to 7 every day, or you're working on weekends or you're bringing your home work with you, you're still getting paid the same £30,000. You're still getting paid the same salary. And so all that's happening is that they're getting a lot more free labor from you for free because they're not paying you extra because you're a salaried worker. It's different if there's overtime, then you literally are being compensated. But for the majority of people who get paid a flat structure, a flat wage or flat salary structure, you're just giving your labor away for free. And the way that we perceive things that are free is that we don't value them. We see them as being cheap because they're easy to come by. So in a way, when we overdo it on the working hard and we do it for a consistent period of time, all that we're doing is that we're communicating to them like unconsciously that we don't value our own time. We don't value our own free time at home, our own leisure time. And we believe that our labor is so cheap or worth less that we're willing to give it away for free. So again, like sometimes we're deluding ourselves when we're putting in all this work. And to be honest, like if you're somebody who has done that, you will feel that burnout and you will feel that resentment that comes from realizing the people around you aren't recognizing you or aren't appropriately rewarding you with either loyalty or compensation for the amount of effort you've put in. So again, like hard work has diminishing returns. So you shouldn't think that the way to career progression is through that avenue. Like combine effective working with good social relationships, and that's going to get you further ahead than just being like the office mule or like the workplace mule, because nobody values the mule. Like that's kind of like the point of the mule. So again, like value your own labor, value your time, value the contract that you signed, and don't Don't do work for free because it doesn't result in the results that you think. Unless you're going to be compensated, unless there's like a bonus that you're playing for. If there's like a bonus structure at the end of the year, then hell yeah, put in that extra effort because you know you're going to be rewarded if people recognize that work. But if there is no bonus structure, then you are honestly just giving away your labor for free, and that doesn't result in them valuing you anymore. It results in them diminishing you. The sixth thing is, and I won't linger on this because it's quite obvious, is like, don't sleep with your work colleagues or your clients, because all that happens is that one is going to get around. Like, people are going to talk, like, everybody has buddies at work. And because work can be monotonous for many people, it can be repetitive. You're doing the same thing over and over again for weeks and months and years. The things that people talk about or gossip about tend to be things that adds excitement or adds like drama or adds like difference or variation to their work life. And so if you sleep with somebody, chances are they're going to pass it on to at least one person, to at least their closest work buddy, because it's something of note in a sea of monotony, in the sea of like things always being the same. Now, if they pass it on to like another colleague who you're friends with, fine. But they may pass it on to their buddy, but their buddy may pass it on to somebody who doesn't like you or somebody who is in competition with you. Or God forbid, they may pass it on to a superior who has like the power to like promote you or not. And if you're sleeping with people who are inappropriate, let's say you passed on that you slept with a client, or you passed on that you slept with like another like person who's like a superior, that's gonna bite you in the butt essentially. And even if nobody finds out, even if it just stays between you and the person you slept with, you're like, the chances that you're gonna be together are kind of low. Like, the rate of breakups are pretty high, never mind the rates of divorce. And so if you're sleeping with people that you work with and you're doing it like more than once, you're gonna end up working with your exes. And what we know about exes is, for a lot of people, they're not nice to you once you've broken up. Like, especially if it breaks up because of something you've done, let's say you've been unfaithful or you've treated them badly or they've perceived your behavior as being badly, then they're going to want to punish you in some way. That could look like sabotaging you by telling people about your relationship, or by talking about you negatively in the workspace, or by not recommending you for promotions or advancements that you deserve out of spite. Either way, like, you're really rolling the dice in terms of your reputation at work, in terms of how the person is going to treat you when they break up, in terms of also like the chances that this doesn't taint you permanently, especially when you're a woman. Because for men, when they sleep around in the office, either they get a slap on their wrists and they're told like not to do it, or they're like actively given like a high five by the other men, especially when they're sleeping with people on the same level and there isn't that obvious abuse of power. They tend to get away like relatively unscathed. For women though, specifically for straight women, like, chances are it's going to negatively impact your reputation. And the reason is very simple. Like, men, insofar as they are rewarded for sleeping with as many people as possible, the person you sleep with, the man you sleep with, is going to be incentivized to tell other people he has slept with you, especially if you're good looking or you're particularly like hard to get, or you're perceived as somebody who's like difficult to approach or difficult to quote unquote conquer. They're going to want to have bragging rights over that fact, and they're going to be incentivized to tell other people and to tell many people. And if they are a particularly like vindictive person, if you break up with them, because most of the time it's women who initiate breakups, then in the context of them being able to use their social capital as a man against you, they're going to do that. Like, the reason why revenge porn is a thing in the real world is because men recognize that sex is viewed negatively when it's done by a woman, and they attempt to shame them with that knowledge. That truth or that fact like shows up in different ways for everyday people outside the revenge porn component. One of those things is trying to taint your reputation knowingly by speaking about you in a degrading or sexual way, or by slipping that information to people who they know to be inappropriate. So the chance that they take some kind of like vindictive action against you is honestly very high in terms of like office politics. So for that alone, it's worth staying away. And in as far as like trying to sleep with like a superior to get ahead, nine times out of 10, it's going to backfire for the very simple reason that the kind of man who will sleep with a junior member of their staff because they see her as ambitious and they know that they're kind of like exchanging sex for advancement is probably not a nice person anyway. And it's probably not the kind of person who's going to like open up doors for you. It's kind of like the Hugh Hefner effect. Hugh Hefner was obviously a very infamous and famous playboy with a significant amount of wealth that he got through the Playboy franchise. And over time, what happened was that women would flock to him and would come to him and would want to be his girlfriend because they knew that if they were his girlfriend and they could feature in his magazine, then basically their career was golden as far as like the adult entertainment business would go. They could gain access to other opportunities just by being his girlfriend, and specifically if he allowed them to be in magazines. And even if she wasn't like career focused, her being with him meant that she had a better quality of life. Like, she could live on his estate free, and he had multiple girlfriends as well, so her responsibilities as far as a girlfriend were very like low. They were distributed amongst all the other girlfriends. And so Hugh Hefner over time knew that. He knew that women, especially when he got older and disgusting, like, he obviously didn't think that these women were attracted to him actually, that they were sexually attracted to him. He knew the reason why they were with him was because of his money and because of his access and because of the opportunities he could provide. And him being the kind of person who'd be willing to exploit women sexually, obviously at a base level, is not a nice person. And so what he did, and you can read this, by the way, in Holly Madison's book, Down the Rabbit Hole, which is actually a very interesting read. What he did over time is that he would make sure that he would be the one who would benefit from those relationships more than they did. So initially, in the early phases of his career, when he like didn't realize as much that women were specifically being with him because of the things he could provide, he would be like generous because he wanted to live up to his Playboy like image. He would buy them cars, he would buy them jewelry, he would give them access to powerful spaces, he would put them in their magazines. But after he got spited over or spurned over and over again, in that they would stay with him until they got what they wanted, and then they would like leave him consistently because, again, at this point he's like a disgusting old man, so they would never stick around that long after they got what they wanted. So what he started doing was that he wouldn't buy anything for them, he would only lease those things out. So he would lease cars for them, he would lease jewelry for them, he would give them like money, but he would give them small amounts of money on a weekly basis. So he might give you like $500 this week and every week, but he wouldn't give you any lump sums of money. He certainly wouldn't give you any money for you to save. And he stipulated that he wanted the money that he gave the girls to be spent on their clothes, on their makeup, on their hair. Essentially, he was saying he didn't want them saving any money because, again, he didn't want them like having the power to leave eventually. Going back to the work context, it's kind of like that with a boss that would sleep with a junior. If they've got such little ethical practices or ethical principles that they would sleep with like a subordinate at work, chances are they've done it multiple times, and chances are they know, especially they're not a good looking man who's just like a sexy man who people gravitate to. He will know like what is attractive about him is his power, and he will have had the experience of feeling used by women who try to sleep their way to the top. And the way that people with men in particular with low morals or low ethical principles who would do such like predatory things or such like things that violate the workplace ethics, he's probably not the kind of person who's going to help you in your career anyway. You know, he's probably the kind of person who's seen you come from a mile away, who has seen other ambitious women who tried to sleep their way to the top. And because he's probably not a nice person at a base level, because he would even engage in that kind of behavior, you're probably not going to get the result that you expect. Chances are he's going to sleep with you and your career is going to remain stagnant. And worst of all, you're going to be in a position where you have to be extra nice to him in case he turns against you. Because if he turns against you, it isn't just like a work colleague who's like spreading rumors about you being fast to other colleagues or getting bragging rights amongst other colleagues. This is somebody who has the power to make your work life miserable by giving you extra work, by giving you the worst assignments, by not progressing you, by turning other people against you, by turning other management against you, by writing you up poorly in annual reviews. Like, the power dynamics are so steep and the chances of success so low that it's honestly not worth pursuing. If anything, and I think I've said this in a previous episode, if you want to harness your sexuality, which I don't recommend, but if you do, the most potent time that your sexuality is, or the most effective your sexuality is when you don't give it away. Because then the person desires you, they hope to get on your good side, they're more incentivized to do things for you because you haven't given it to them and they're trying to get something out of you. So it's most powerful when it's bottled up and not given away. Like, that's just a fun fact. But either way, I don't recommend that you do it. The seventh thing on the list, and I'm getting towards nearly the end, is that you shouldn't skip work functions. And I'm the kind of person who I don't want to go to work functions, especially if all we're going to do is talk about work. Like, we're talking about work through work hours because we don't talk about specifically or particularly intimate things in the workspace. That's just like a norm. And then on top of that, we're going to spend extra hours, like, let's say the hours between like 5:30 and 8 or 5:30 and 9, engaging in more small talk and more workplace focused small talk. Like, that's not my idea of a good time. And it's not many people's idea of a good time. So there's a temptation to want to get out of them. But the thing about these events is, besides being dry and boring, is that they're the place where you are actually going to find out the real information about what's going on at your workplace. When people have been like cooped up at work all day and then they're at a social event where there's alcohol, because 9 times out of 10 there is going to be alcohol, the more drinks that people have at the party, the looser their lips become. And so you're going to find out information about promotions, about opportunities coming up, about how people feel about each other, about how people feel about your manager, about how your manager feels about other work colleagues, about what their pet peeves are. Basically, valuable information that you cannot afford to be without, because you need this information to move strategically at work, which ties back to what I said before about how hard work is not the be an end all of progressing. Other things are significantly more important. And one of those things that are very important is understanding the social dynamics and the political dynamics at play at work, because they're the things that allow you to move smartly. So again, work functions are unmissable for that specific reason, but also for another reason. The reason is that your workplace has spent money on this. There's been a committee or a group of people who've been tasked with organizing the event, who've put in effort to organize the event. So maybe they've booked a venue, maybe they've like ordered food, they've sent around an email trying to get everybody's like health or food requirements or dietary requirements, finding out who can't eat what food. They've gone to the effort of making sure the place has an alcohol license, making sure the insurance is right, coordinating who's going to be there, making sure the bosses are going to be there. So there's a great deal of effort and money that goes into running these events. And so if you never show up to the event, it's basically spurning their efforts. It's spurning the efforts of the people who organize the event. And it's also spurning the money that the company has put in. And people notice, like, I learned this the hard way, people notice when you're not at these events. They look around and they remember the faces who weren't there. Because what happens is that at these events, you end up getting closer to people in a way that doesn't necessarily happen when you're working together all day long. Because when you're in these environments, especially when there's alcohol, you're more likely to talk about personal things. You're more likely to be having a laugh with this person. They're more likely to let things slip or to be conspiratorial with you. All that stuff you're missing out on when you don't go. And so the next day, what happens is that the people who did go to the event, they are there and they're like giggling and laughing and having these inside jokes and these inside connections that they've developed over the course of going to these functions, these after work functions. And when you don't go, you're basically putting yourself at a disadvantage. So it doesn't mean you have to go all the time. It doesn't mean that you have to stay the entire time when you go, but make no mistake, like, you 100% should go. At least like go to 1 in every 3. And even if you don't stay for the whole thing, which I don't, stay for like an hour and a half, but make sure you speak to a lot of people. Make sure you're visible. Make sure you have a laugh with a few people and then slip away quietly. But then at least everybody can remember that they saw you at the event. They had a positive interaction with you. And if you stay long enough, chances are you're going to pick up on some tidbit that's going to be useful for you later on. Also, by the way, when you were at these functions, like, the rules of charming people work, and the thing to remember is don't spend too much time speaking about you. Like, the mistake that people make sometimes is to think that the way into people's hearts is to speak about yourself and to make yourself be super interesting and to, like, basically open up fully to people. And whilst that's, like, a component of it, people need to know, like, they know something about you, as I've spoken about before. The more important thing is to make people feel seen and make people feel heard and to make it feel like you are genuinely interested in what they have to say. So be curious about the things that they're curious about. Be interested about the things that they are doing or they are working on. Like, make them feel like they've got your full attention. And that way, even if you spend like just 10 minutes with them, it'll feel like 10 minutes where somebody was super engaged with them versus like an hour where somebody's like talking about themselves. Like, ultimately, people are... they're kind of self-centered in that way. And that's why you can spend an hour chatting to somebody where they haven't necessarily asked you anything about yourself, but they'll walk away feeling like you're a great conversationalist only because you allow them to speak about themselves for an hour. So again, like, you're going to these functions with purpose. The purpose is to get information. The purpose is to foster good, positive relationships and also to basically stick out in people's minds. And that's the way to do it. The eighth thing that I've learned from my work experience so far is you should save money. Like, I know we talk about all the time about living within your means, about like not being frivolous with your spending, about how it's very important to plan for the future, and all those things are true. But it's also important for your own sense of self-esteem on a daily basis, because when you're living paycheck to paycheck, and by that I mean not that you can't afford to put money away, but because you just live frivolously, which I have been very guilty of, is that it affects how you walk around in the workplace. It affects how you interact with your superiors. It affects how you interact with your colleagues. And how it affects you is that I feel like you walk around in a sort of servile way. You're too eager to please. You're too eager to say yes to everything. You're too eager to just be like this yes, yes, yes person, this no boundary person, this I will do anything person. And the reason why you're doing that is because you know that you need to pay your rent and your bills next month. And because you don't have any money put aside, you basically are letting that affect how you move in the workplace. It's affecting your attitude. It's affecting your behavior. And believe me, like, it affects how people feel when they're interacting with you. Because it'll be the wrong side of being too nice. It'll be the wrong side of being too compliant or too agreeable. You know, it'll feel like... sometimes people can even feel like you have something to hide because you're too nice. And little do they know, you just can't afford to lose that job because you don't have any savings. So again, the value of having savings is basically it makes you stand up tall because you know that no matter what happens, you have enough money to walk away with dignity. Like, if you know you have enough money in the bank to live a comfortable life for the next year or for the next 6 months, then when you experience disrespect in the workplace or bullying in the workplace or racism in the workplace or sexism in the workplace or just negative experiences with your manager, for example, or with your colleagues, you don't have to be depressed and get down and feel hopeless and helpless and stuck because you have screw you money. You've got F you money. You've got money to say, I'm not going to tolerate this behavior. I'm leaving. And when you have that knowledge in your mind and you have that money and you know that at the back of your head, believe you me, it affects how you walk around. It affects how you speak. You speak with more authority. You speak with more confidence. You're better able to set boundaries. So having screw your money is very important, not just for your own security, that it isn't a disaster if you lose your job, because especially in this economy, it's a possibility 100%. But it also genuinely makes you stand up tall and actually allows you to be more yourself. Because when you're operating from a place of fear, a place of losing, a fear of losing your job, or a fear of, you know, not having your job and all the negative things that could happen because of that, your full self isn't going to come to the table. What's going to come to the table is the people pleaser side of you, the side of you that can only say yes, the side of you that doesn't know how to say no, the side of you that doesn't know how to set boundaries. So again, screw your money. Honestly, like, there's nothing that's going to make you feel more confident in the workplace than that and more empowered than that. This two last things I would actually say are probably the two biggest lessons I've learned. And they're the ones that can be harder to remember the longer you've been there, especially if you enjoy your work, enjoy your colleagues, and you're comfortable where you are. And that is the idea of knowing when to leave, right? So the thing about work is that no matter how much we like it and enjoy the work and enjoy the people and enjoy everything about it, we are always going to be a number on the ledger. Like, the company has two main, like ignore everything they say on the website about their mission statement and about their values and their commitment to community and the fact that you're a family and the fact that they really value their employees. All that stuff is mostly not true because they live by two rules. The first is self-preservation. So they will do anything to survive as a company. And second is that their number one and in some extent really only priority or only true like loyalty is to the shareholder. They have to make sure that they deliver value to the shareholders. Now, what that means for you, what that means for us as workers is that if they have to make sure that they are always self-preserving and that they always deliver value to the shareholder, that means that you are always dispensable. You are always like, what's the word? Disposable. That's the word. You're always disposable. Like when times get tough, when things are difficult, when financially things are difficult, when the market is bad, for whatever reason, the chances that they're going to get rid of you is very, very high. We saw this during the pandemic, especially where Virgin is concerned. Like the way they are actually so evil. I remember at the onset of the pandemic, this is like week one. This is like week one when the UK had shut down. Virgin essentially fires like 60% of its staff, like a crazy percentage of its staff. And this is before like we even know how long like lockdown is going to be. This is before we know like anything really about how long this issue, this pandemic was going to last. They literally got rid of them like so, so quick. And the fact is that if you go onto Virgin's website now, you will see all kinds of stuff talking about how they value their employees, about how they value the people who work for them, how they're at the center of their business. But we saw during the pandemic how they truly feel about their workers. And that's true of many other workplaces. It's not that, you know, it's not that they mostly don't have a little bit of wiggle room. So they might hang on a little bit when times are tough. But believe you me, they won't be hanging on that long. Now, what that means for us as workers is that we should leave at the first sign of a sinking ship. The minute you sense that something is wrong financially, that the company is going under, that the company is struggling financially, you should be polishing off your CV and you should start to apply for roles immediately. Because one, turnarounds are notoriously very rare. Like once a company starts going down, it takes a lot for it to get back on track. One, usually they have to refinance or get finance or get some kind of debt. Usually they have to let people go. Usually they have to cost. It's a lot of effort. So once you sense that things are wrong, and you always see it coming, it'll be things like you always have a Christmas party and it's at a particular standard. And then this year, for some reason, they say we're not having a Christmas party. Or if you do have a Christmas party, let's say you're used to going to like a really snazzy place. You usually go to like, usually they book out a whole venue. It's in a fabulous area. It's in a fabulous restaurant or a bar or whatever. And then this time they're taking you to like Nando's, or they're taking you to McDonald's, or they're taking you to somewhere where there's just a noticeable like decline in the standard. That's a clue that they are doing badly financially. Or let's say you were expecting a bonus and you worked hard, you deserve that bonus. And every other year when you put in that level of effort and you have that level of positive feedback, you get a bonus, but this year you didn't. That's a sign that they're struggling. Or let's say like you start to notice that they are conscious about little cost things. Like they're suddenly like sending around emails talking about how people are using too much stationery. Or you notice they used to provide like four different types of milks and now it's just like down to two. Or you notice you used to get like free lunch like most weeks or every other week or at a particular interval and now that's no longer there. Again, it's all signs that things are going downhill and it's signs that you should leave as soon as possible because as I said, if they have only loyalty to themselves and their self-preservation and to their shareholders, it means that you and your concerns and your well-being never even makes it to the top 10 of the things that they care about. So you shouldn't hang around for the axe to come down on you. You should leave while you're still in a relatively powerful negotiating position. And usually you have better negotiation power when you still have a job, when you're still employed. It just comes across better in your interview. It doesn't feel like you're desperate. They know that you're employed, so you don't need that job. And so when you see that things are going downhill or that the company is struggling financially, that's the best time to apply for a job, because you're much more likely to, one, get a job, and also you're going to get a job in conditions where it's not stressful. You haven't been made redundant. You haven't been made fired. They haven't been finding ways to get rid of you. And so you're doing it from a position of calmness and from a position of you being in control, as opposed to like delaying the action for months or weeks and then finding out that things are in fact going downhill. And then it's on their terms. You have to find a job when you've been let go, for example. So anyway, like, first signs of a sinking ship, just like leave. Connected to that as well, under this point, is I've learned the hard way that there's no point complaining about your manager to HR, or complaining about like management in general, or people with like who are superior to you to HR or to like their boss. All that's going to happen is that they're going to take their side, because they're always going to side with the person who's been there longer, the person who makes them more money, and the person with seniority. And so when you complain, all you've done is that you've put a target on your back. It's only a matter of time until like the conditions in the workplace deteriorate for you, because the manager you've complained about might not strike against you then and there, because they're smarter than that. They're going to wait until some time has lapsed. But believe me, the countdown has begun to them treating you worse. So instead of complaining about your manager, polish off your CV and find somewhere else. They always say that people don't leave bad workplaces, they leave bad management. And that's true for a reason, because they hold a lot of the power in that interaction. And it's unlikely you're going to be able to change their behavior, even if you speak to them one-on-one. And it's unlikely that their workplace is going to do anything about it, even when you go to complain about them to HR. So leave. Like, always recognize the writings on the wall and leave when it is advantageous and when you're in the best negotiation position. The final thing is, and an old boss told me this and I've never forgotten about that. And by the way, he was like my favorite boss of all time. But he told me something that, like, I knew, but I'd kind of forgotten. I'd never thought about it in those terms. And what he said to me was, he said, like, let me give you the background first of all. We had this new partner come on who was a complete prick. When I say he was a complete prick, like, he was the kind of guy who would like take on all your work and not give you, like, take all your work and never give you any props in front of the other colleagues, in front of the other managers. He would always be hyper critical of your work, but never give you any positive ways to improve. I found out that he was like just making up stuff, like just was not a team player in any way. And he went to one of my mentors who I like really looked up to, really valued. And he basically said that I wasn't delivering my work, which one thing I know for sure about myself is that I do the work I'm supposed to do, and I do it on time and I do it well. And it's actually the reason why I was promoted twice in that workplace. So I was like, I don't know why he would say that. So anyway, I end up like getting off the phone call with my mentor, and I'm furious. I'm absolutely furious. But I don't show it at work, obviously. And I end up like recording, because I just knew that he was lying to my mentor, to my other manager. So I was like, I'm not going to trust him not to lie. So I recorded myself asking him, and I was like, oh, hey, I just got off the phone with so-and-so, and he said that there's some work that I hadn't delivered for you. And then he's like caught off guard that I would even like ask him like up front. And he starts to like look around his desk for his notebook. And he's like, he points to a couple of things. He's like, oh, well, I thought we had discussed you doing this. And he goes through the list, and I've literally done absolutely everything. And in fact, it's him who hasn't like come back to me on the work that I had delivered to him. He hadn't given me feedback. And what I worked out from that was that he was trying to get cachet with the other managers by making it seem like he was like managing me, and he was like correcting me, and he was like setting me straight, like I needed to be set straight. So he was basically using me to make himself look good by making me look bad, and that he was correcting me. Long story short, one day, like, my favorite like manager, not the one who called me to tell me about like this guy on what he had said, but the one who I had like lots of conversations with, we talked about all kinds of life things, and he's genuinely a lovely person. He noticed that I had been giving him the cold shoulder, and I was honestly surprised that he noticed. I thought I was being very discreet, but he basically pulled me aside and he said, like, don't let him get to you. Like, this is not real life. And he said, like, we're basically here to work, and we do this work and we like this work, but this is not our real life. Our real life is what happens outside of work. It's our friends, it's our family, it's our real life. And so being upset about this person and letting it get to the point where it's affecting me emotionally, to the point where I'm giving him the cold shoulder and I'm letting this beef sort of like progress for weeks now at this stage, there's no point. There's no point being that emotionally invested because it's not real life. So anyway, the minute he said that, like, my whole anger, as I said, like, just completely dissipated, because I realized that I had forgotten that that is true. And what's really annoying is that I already knew that, but you, when you're in work, you can be drawn into like these petty beefs to the point where you lose sight of the things you know to be true. So that was him reminding me of like something like, you shouldn't let work get to you. Like, the range of emotions you have at work should be honestly very limited. Like, it should range from a mild irritation to like satisfaction. There shouldn't be any massive swings where you're crying or you're feeling hopeless and helpless or you're feeling lost or you're feeling like angry. Like, that's too much emotion to commit to work, to commit to something that you only do because you have to earn a living in this life and not because you love working. So putting it in its proper context, you kind of realize, honestly, there's no point in having these extreme emotions at work, and there's no point being so dedicated and so committed to work that you neglect your actual real life, like your actual friends and family, like your actual passions. Because when it's all said and done, you're not gonna remember this like in 20 years time. Even places where you spent like 5 years at, when you look at your CV, it's reduced to like 5 bullet points. It doesn't even impact the overall career anyways. Like, it doesn't have the lasting impression that you think that it's going to have. It doesn't have the lasting impact that you think it's going to have. And so sacrificing your actual life and being so emotionally connected, emotionally invested, that you become riled up emotionally or you give too much of yourself emotionally, indicates that you have forgotten that it's not real life. So I feel like that was one of the best things that he could have reminded me of, because now I don't take work that deeply. Like, it doesn't mean that I don't get irritated. It doesn't mean there aren't things that colleagues can do that annoy me. But the chances that I take it outside work or I become like affected by it in any permanent way is very, very low. So anyway, I'm going to wrap up this episode there. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you found the survival guide useful. I'm sure you knew a lot of these things as well, just from your own work experience, but still hope there are some things that you might not have thought about. Again, thanks again for tuning in. I'll catch you next week.